He's our voice of reason in the medical world. Dr. Fred Brown from Griffin Health talks to Melissa in the morning on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Dr. Brown, welcome back on the show. How are you?
I'm well. How are you, Melissa?
I can't complain. Thank you so much for asking. I saw a news article, actually, just a few weeks ago, and I thought I meant to bring this up to you, but we had that breaking news last week about RSV and the flu, right. So we didn't get to talk about it. So CT Insider had a story about a Yale study, and it found a huge jump in asthma ER visits because of the wildfire smoke that was going through our region back in the beginning of the summertime. And I wasn't sure if you could talk a little bit about this and why it's important to take those air quality alerts really seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so it is very interesting. And I think we have seen an increase in asthma and asthma attacks. So asthma is in a lot of different ways. There's a couple of different forms of asthma, but one of the best ways to sort of explain it is a reactive airway. I think that sort of puts it into context. So you think about it, it is your airway that is reacting to something, right? Now, sometimes it's reactive to, you know, just because. I mean, sometimes asthma attacks just occur. Usually it's associated with something that is irritating the airways. And when it irritates the airways, what it does is it causes a spasm in your airway. So it's spasm in your bronchus, and that causes this tightening, and that causes wheezing and asthma. So putting that all together, when you have poor air quality, what happens is you're getting these small little particles that are getting into your lungs. Your body's natural response, everybody's natural response, is to get rid of those. Mm-hmm. We cough them up. We have a little cilia that actually get rid of them. By the way, those cilia don't work if you smoke, but anyways, those cilia actually get rid of those little particles, and off you go. The problem is that some people are very sensitive by having those particles down there, and instead of just having that cough and having that thing, they actually contract or spasm, and we call that bronchospasms. So you're actually having spasms of your bronchus that's now irritated by the air quality, and again by these small particles.
So is asthma something that you can develop later in life? I always had it in my mind that it's something that you're born with.
Interesting enough, so asthma itself, the asthma diagnosis, I said there's a couple ways that you can actually get it. Asthma is an allergic reaction. Atopia is the word we use. That means that you react to certain things that are associated with it. And there is some genetic component to that. Unfortunately, there are a large component of people nowadays that have what's just reactive airway that may not even kind of fits in the category of asthma, but not really. These are the people who end up having, if the air quality is poor, they'll end up having reactions. If they have a virus, they'll actually have some reactive airway, so they'll end up getting wheezing. So these bronchoconstrictions actually occur. So the answer is that it's not always that clear that you have to be born with it. And in some ways, we all have a little bit of a component of asthma. Now, the full diagnosis of asthma has a clinical aspect of it, and there are some diagnostic tests to say, okay, you are an asthmatic. But again, I think all of us can have, and it probably you've had in your life, Melissa, also, is that you have a bad bronchitis and you have wheezing. That's essentially reactive airways and essentially a small portion of what we would consider asthma.
So we have Dr. Fred Brown of Griffin Health here, and we always ask him our infectious disease questions, and that was something that came to mind. Another thing is, I have to be honest, Dr. Brown, I start my morning the same way every single day. I come in here 3 o'clock in the morning, get my studio ready. Oh, it's delightful. It's great.
3 a.m. Ouch.
It's beautiful. And I sit and I sanitize. I do my whole thing. And then I start to watch the nightly news. And every single morning for the past week, really the focus has been on, with the Israel-Hamas war going on, the focus has been on the hospitals. And I wanted to know from your perspective, like, to understand better, regardless of where people stand with the war, which is a whole other, that's a whole separate thing. I want to understand the dire situation these patients are in these Gaza hospitals, because like, I'm looking at babies who are out of incubators, and I don't know how they're still surviving, premature babies. So I didn't know if, I'm sure you've had kind of an eye on what's going on overseas, but if you could sort of explain how, like, what's happening? Because I don't think it's something we've ever seen at a hospital here in Connecticut, at least.
Right, absolutely. And this is the concern, and this sort of fits into the category of, you know, of a disaster. I mean, again, this is war, so it is, in fact, by definition, a disaster. What happens is that you just imagine there's all portions of healthcare that's associated with this. So, you know, healthcare has developed really well, and even in this area, even in Israel and even in the Palestine. I mean, ultimately, healthcare has gotten a lot better. So people are vaccinated, people are, you know, treated well, and those things are there. So the likelihood that you're going to need a hospital is relatively low if things are normal. So you're not necessarily going to go in there. If you do need to go into a hospital, that means something bad's happening. And if you don't have the resources that are there, then that obviously leads to significant issues. No electricity, no clean running water. These lead to bigger issues. So that's the first issue, is that not having the intensive medical equipment and personnel that can assist people who are sick is obviously the first major issue. The second issue is, because of the electricity issue, because of the bombing, there's concerns about, always a concern about sanitation, close contacts, lack of sanitation leads to an outcropping of infectious diseases. It can even lead to increase in certain pests. And those pests can carry germs with them. They carry bugs with them. They carry, you know, the mosquitoes can increase. All those things can occur. And what we start seeing is, not only do we see people who are sick coming into the hospital, but then we start seeing people get sick because of the situation and then have to go to the hospital. So our next thing is that we need to be, and this is why you keep hearing about, you know, we need to take a break for humanitarian reasons, because we need to go back in there and we need to make sure that, you know, clean water is there, that, you know, that people are, that the pests are eliminated, that garbage isn't sort of accumulating, that there isn't all these other things that are occurring, because those in itself will cause this whole cyclical demand for healthcare.
Well, that's what I was kind of getting at as well, is not just to also take a picture of what is happening, because I think many of us really can't fathom what's really going on, because it's not happening in hospitals in Connecticut or across the country. But that was my other concern, is the spread of infectious diseases when you have such a humanitarian crisis, which is going on in Gaza right now. I mean, what could, I guess, and again, I know you don't have a crystal ball with you, but like, what could that translate to be, and how that would impact, you know, even the United States at some point? Like, is this something that could turn into something spreading and making its way to North America?
So there's always a possibility. The immediate concerns are going to be things that are transmitted person to person is always the biggest issue when you're dealing with crisis like this, refugee crisis, et cetera. So we're talking about, and again, I keep using the word sanitation, because I think that's probably the key here. So if you can imagine not having clean water or having your water contaminated, that's probably a major issue that occurs. Mm-hmm. So we could see potential outbreaks of cholera. I mean, that's a real possibility of occurring. I mean, if you don't have proper sanitation, that means garbage can go. That means we can have an increase in rats. That can mean we can see potential outbreaks of plague. I mean, there's all those things are, the bets are off when there's a disaster like this. So the concerning is, it's going to be for the local population. The likelihood that there's going to be any new virus or something that's selected out during this period is relatively low. So globally, I think this is a crisis there, and I think there's more deaths that are potentially going to be associated with infectious diseases in that area. The likelihood that it's going to sort of spread to the world is pretty low. There's not going to be a new virus that's going to come out of this because of it. But there is the toll of a lot of disasters and a lot of wars throughout the centuries is actually, the toll comes, you know, from the direct battles, but a lot of it comes the secondary infections.
Mm-hmm.
And those, and you look at every war that's kind of occurred, or any conflict or any disaster, even natural disasters, you look at them and you see what the increases in the diseases that occur. You know, we see this usually in like Haiti. If there's a hurricane, you know, and there's and their sanitation goes, or they end up having inability to protect against mosquitoes. They end up getting yellow fever outbreaks and chikungunya and other viruses that occur in that area because those vectors are not controlled.
It was actually in our news earlier this week that the Asian longhorned tick has been detected in, I think, 19 states, including Connecticut. Apparently, it's a bigger problem for cattle than it is for people, and it shouldn't cause any concern when it comes to Lyme disease numbers. But I am curious. We have Dr. Brown here, our infectious disease expert on the show. Are we worried about more of these types of insects or pests or ticks coming into Connecticut and causing more concern? So, like, we've got this invasive species, which I think is a bigger concern for the cows than they are the people, but it begs the question, like, what else could be here and causing concern?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think there's two factors, I think, both of which we've talked a little bit about. The first factor is the global warming. And as the temperature gets warmer, we see different types of species of insects that come into the United States and are sort of creep up the coast. So obviously we're very careful about that and monitor that very closely, in particular mosquitoes being a big factor. And we've talked about, yellow fever and other things that have actually been identified in Florida and in Texas and some of the southern states. But we're always watching that and very careful about that. So I think that's one factor. The other factor is that globalization of everything. If you're getting your Amazon package or your order from China, I mean, that's not the only thing that kind of comes there. Unfortunately, we do have the ability, and we are very careful about when we do ship to prevent the spread of insects. But again, if we're traveling or other people are traveling or it sneaks onto something, then the concern is that they can come in. We've heard about a lot of different insects that have come in, including things like the murder wasp and,
right.
and other things that
the
are
hornets
there.
Hornets and all that the stuff, yeah.
Yeah, murder hornet, that's what it mm-hmm. is, yeah. So we've definitely heard about those, and I think we just need to be aware that, and it's interesting because even when I teach the PA students, the physician assistant students, about infectious diseases, we actually talk about what are the global infectious diseases, because you never know when they're potentially going to show up in the United States.
Yeah.
So I think that's something that you just need to be aware of. And I think, you know, the more that we are knowledgeable as medical providers to understand what these are and how we manage them becomes important. And even with this new tick, just taking a quick look, I mean, in other countries, it does cause infectious diseases in humans. Now, it does not carry Lyme disease. In Connecticut, the tick that actually carries that is called the Ixodes tick, and that is the deer tick.
Okay.
So it's very specific to that tick. There are other ticks already in Connecticut. There's the wood tick. There's the dog tick. Those don't carry Lyme disease. However, as I always have to say, sorry, Melissa. However, there are other viruses and atypical bacteria and parasites that can be carried by the dog, the wood, and now this tick. We haven't seen it in the U.S. yet, but outside of the U.S., as we were sort of saying, we just need to keep what's going on outside of the U.S. It does carry things like anaplasmosis and babesiosis and ehrlichiosis and rickettsiosis. So those are
all the osis. So, be careful.
All
the
osis. Watch out for the osis. So those are atypical bacteria. Anaplasmosis and ehrlichia are relatively common in can be common in the deer tick also. So we do deal with that. I mean, I'm sure some of your listeners have actually had this. It's pretty straightforward to treat. Babesiosis is a parasite, usually self-limiting, so it goes away on its own. But sometimes it can get patients very sick, and we have to use a special antiparasitic treatment for that. The issue is going to be is that are there going to be any viruses that it carries? Because the viruses are not treatable. And if they're not treatable, that gets a little trickier to deal with. And we do know that some significant viruses are carried by the ticks in Connecticut, that carry things like flebivirus and other things.
And really quick, because I know we've run out of time, Dr. Brown, but I did want to get your perspective on this. New research coming out of the University of Texas Health System. Gargling with salt water will keep COVID patients out of the hospital. Why would that be?
so it's interesting because we know that this virus is relatively sensitive to environmental factors. So I'm not surprised. It's just quantity and how much you want to do. I mean, in a lab situation, yeah. If you increase the saline content of your saliva, yeah, the virus won't survive. We know that this virus is pretty weak in that aspect. So if you're careful, I mean, you can wear a mask. That'll prevent it. If you change sort of, in this case, your salinity of your saliva. Then yeah, it's not going to be able to attach. If it doesn't attach, then it can't cause an infection. But the reality of that, I would just be really careful about that. I mean, we don't want our congestive heart failure patients to be gargling with salt, or hypertensive people who have high blood pressure gargling with salt.
That might not be a good idea. That's fair.
We may prevent COVID, but then you know they're going to have fluid in their lungs and fluid in their legs and other issues. So yeah, it's interesting. I'm not surprised about that. Just like, you know, if you have UV light, we know that kills the virus. So not surprised, but again, I don't know how practical that's going to be in managing patients. I don't think I'm going to actually prescribe people, daily salt water. It's probably multiple salt water gargling.
So. Well, there you go. Dr. Brown, certainly talk to your primary care physician. Always the biggest
advice. Absolutely.
Right. Exactly. Well, Dr. Brown, appreciate you always. I hope you and your wife, your beautiful family, have a fantastic Thanksgiving, and we'll talk to you in December.
Absolutely.
All right.
You too.
Looking forward to it. Dr. Brown of Griffin Health here on WICC.